good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Monday, August 17th, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
Hello, Melody.
Well, it's been another great day for gold today. And I mean, we're just going to sit back now and watch all these prices rise, both in gold and silver. And we've been waiting for a long time, although over this long period of time of even 25 years, gold has always done well. And it always, you know, as long as we're on this fiat currency with this, the world being led by debt, it will be. So we're looking at gold today up $38.60 at $1,984. We were at 1991, so a great day for gold, 1983. Silver was up 99 cents at $27.53. Platinum was up 12 bucks at 956. Palladium was up 86 at 2,246. The USDX today was down 0.28 at 92.81. Crude oil was up 81 cents at 42.82. And the paper markets today, they were again kind of all over the page. The Dow was down 85 points at 27,845. You have the NASDAQ up 108 at 11,128. The S&P was up 9 at 3,382. 10-year yield, 0.68%. That was down a little bit. European, Asian markets, nothing to talk about. But I think one of the most interesting buy stocks of the day, or announcements anyway, was Barrick Gold's stock purchase by Warren Buffett. And I can't even remember how many years it's been. Warren Buffett hates gold. And he's never made a secret about it either. But he's has bought a new stake in Barrick Gold. And we always know Barrick Gold is, you know, one of the insider companies. That's why it's Barrick Gold that he's buying. And so the Barrick soared more than 10% today on that news. And, of course, you had the other miners like Newmont and so forth kind of follow along. But, I mean, this just goes to show you where everyone knows where gold is headed. Now, this one article I was reading, Dave, it says, Wall Street perceives gold as a safe haven. Yeah, well, they might perceive it as that, but they sure don't like it because they don't make money on it. They can't trade it. But I mean, and the big thing that I believe is pushing the dollars, pushing the gold price is the weakness in the dollar, but that's not the only reason. So now all of a sudden, you know, I can remember Dave Barrett used to say that a gold was just a cube that doesn't do anything. This was, you know, goes back almost 10 years ago. And yet gold has been outperforming all the paper markets this year. And so, again, it's just another sign, that someone that, you know, I'm not a fan of, but you have to look at where they're going and what they're buying. And, you know, it's just another, and what we've been saying for years and years and years. And when these guys start coming into the market, big pullbacks will be temporary. And then you're going to have this reversal. And, you know, so not all is well. I mean, another reason the stock market was up so high during Trump's election, of course, was the tariffs with China and the phase one deal, trade deal with China before the virus. And now you're beginning to see that China is coming out and saying that the Fed stimulus is risking or perhaps creating a global crisis. So, you know, first there was a tit-for-tat trade war, Then came the game of chicken in the South China Seas. Now you're talking about central bank stimulus and its ramifications. The Federal Reserve's unparalleled stimulus risks, you know, is plunging the world into financial crisis. And we were heading there anyway. But that's according to the chair of China's banking watchdog, who also warned that these bad debts at Chinese financial institutions could balloon significantly this year due to the impact of the pandemic. China Banking Regulatory Commission Chairman Guai Shuging said, in an international monetary system that is dominated by the U.S. dollar, the unprecedented, unlimited quantitative easing policy of the United States actually consumes the creditworthiness of the dollar and erodes the foundation of global financial stability.
Yeah, he added, Melody, that the world may once again be pushed to the verge of a global financial crisis. Perhaps he means a deeper global financial crisis, because I kind of thought we were already in one. But he continued that for China's financial sector, after the black swan of the pandemic, asset quality will inevitably deteriorate. Nguo's warning comes on the heels of a similar warning from him, where he cautioned that easy access to funding could spark a reemergence of financial irregularities, presumably in his country, and that China should make preparations to deal with a rise in non-performing assets. So, Melody, round and round the volatility goes. Where it stops, who the heck knows? The only question is, will it stop? And to that I say, no, it won't. At least not anytime soon. It just keeps ramping up, up, and away.
You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation this morning with a financial planner, analyst. And he's talking about there's just really no place. He says, you might have these numbers going up in the paper markets. He says, but they really don't mean anything. He says, nobody's making any money. He says, and everybody in the know knows that it's bound to be doomed. But yet they continue to pump the uninformed investor out there, people who are holding their retirement accounts, just trusting. So, you know, it's just really amazing. I mean, what they believe, but yet what they sell are just two totally different things. And it's so many people are going to be hurt, because a lot of your financial planners and so forth are just told what to do. They all follow the same system. They all follow the same percentages. None of them, few of them, think outside the box. So you could go to A, B, C, D, E, F, G company and still get all the same. It's not going to change for you. And the more you chase yields, the greater your risk of losing more. But yet that's where they all put you, because that's the only way they can show that they're, you know, that they're, you know, that their accounts that they've been working with show any type of gains at all. So it really is amazing. And, you know, people just can't grasp that Wall Street is doomed. And along that goes your money and the U.S. dollar. Because it's debt. It's just not our debt. It's global debt. And China has one coming out and saying, oh, they're concerned about us, our stimulus. What the heck do you think they're doing? You know, I guarantee you their stimulus is more or not greater, you know, but that they're putting into their markets just to, you know, they force their people, they force their investors to buy their stocks. They're told, you know, all their investors are told what to do by the government. So it's, Dave, it just baffles me. And, you know, their game, and that's what it is, it's their game just to keep these numbers high. And it's an election year. I don't know why this election year would be any different. We all know during election years they stretch the truth to high and, you know, to whatever levels they can. So, I mean, it just is, you know, and we bring you these reports. You know, here's another one. You can't shut down global economies. I mean, we were in a recession since February. The shutdowns, at least here in the States, didn't start until middle of March or April. Globally, they started earlier, but that wouldn't have an impact on our recession. Finally, Europe's come out and said, hey, gee, we're in a recession too. But who talks about it? You know, we keep bringing you numbers and everything. The Federal Housing Administration mortgages now have the highest delinquency rate in at least four decades. The share of late FHA loans rose to almost 16% in the second quarter, up from about 9.7% in the previous 3 months. And that's the highest level in record dating back to 1979. Millions of Americans have stopped paying their mortgages after losing jobs. Those on the lower end of the income scale, I mean, they're most likely to have the FHA loans. I don't know. I guess you could consider those subprime loan mortgages. It's not any different than what we had in 2008. Last month, the MBA said about 4.1 million homeowners, represents about 8.2% of loan balances, were in forbearance, Dave.
Yeah, pretty stark numbers there. I mean, housing has held up better than expected in an otherwise shaky economy, one of the few sectors showing some hints of positivity, with record low mortgage rates fueling sales of both new and previously owned houses. And with job losses mounting and Congress slow to act on stimulus 4.0, that momentum is now threatened. New Jersey had the highest FHA delinquency rate at 20%. The state also had the biggest increase in overall late payment rate, jumping to 11. That's up from 4.7. Following that were Nevada, New York, Florida, and Hawaii, all states with a high portion of leisure and hospitality jobs that were especially hard hit by the pandemic. But the current spike in delinquencies, this article says, is different from the Great Recession, thanks in part to years of home price gains and equity accumulation, which is much higher than it was in the years leading up to that financial crisis. Still, things are likely to get worse, if not much worse, this time around, before they get any better, Melody.
Well, you know, you talk about the housing market, and, you know, you had these builders, you know, because of the low rates, you know, you had people flooding to subdivisions and so forth, and, you know, these builders were feeling pretty good. Probably better than any time over the past, 20 years or so? Well, I can't say 20 years. I can't imagine the builders felt well during the crisis, the financial crisis of 2008. But lumber prices, you know, we've seen builder confidence in new single-family homes jump 6 points to 78 in August on the National Association of Home Builders Index. And, I mean, this is big. Builder sentiment plunged to 30 in April when all the pandemic started. Everybody talks about a V-shaped recovery. Well, I disagree with a V-shaped recovery. There is no V-shaped recovery. But perhaps the cost of lumber is something that is just something else that's going to put more pressure in the housing market when you see more delinquencies beginning to occur, Dave.
Well, the cost of lumber is soaring not only because of increased demand, but because mills shut down in April and May and didn't expect to see the kind of strong demand they're all of a sudden seeing now. There have also been issues with transportation and labor that have contributing to this rise. Now, of the index's three components, current sales conditions rose 6 points to 84. Sales expectations in the next 6 months increased 3 points to 78, and buyer traffic jumped 8 points to 65. I mean, builders are clearly benefiting from the severe shortage of existing homes for sale. There were too few homes to meet demand even before the pandemic struck, and now fewer homeowners are willing to list their homes. Mortgage rates dropped to record lows and to start this month, but pushed higher last week as Treasury yields rose and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac increased fees to lenders by 0.5 percentage point. Unless rates really break much higher, which is unlikely for now, at least according to the Fed, the latest increase is unlikely to throw much cold water on the strong demand for housing that is the latest increase in lumber prices. But who knows? We're in interesting times, and all bets are off on the way things normally work. Melanie?
Well, you know, Jerome Powell, the Fed, it looks like they're, you know, I mean, this is all such a joke, you know, but hey, we wanted to bring some levity to today's program, so we thought we'd talk about Jerome Powell and his the Fed's, you know, direction of 2% inflation. Now, that should make us all laugh. And now they're looking to, they're going to tolerate inflation rising a little bit above 2%, that they favor it, and that they're going to aim for that direction. That's been like what we've said for a long time. They need the inflation. They want the inflation. Even though they're lying about it. But, you know, we are going to have rising inflation. Period. More so than what they claim, and then more so than what we believe it is, that what it is, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, we may learn more on Wednesday when the Fed releases its minutes of its of last month's Federal Open Market Committee meeting. Be interesting to see if they do say anything, how they posture it. Now, some say the shift in how the Fed seeks to control inflation may sound trivial, but they think, some think it's actually significant. Well, it's been significant, and as Melody said, we speak truth to power, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back. We're heading into a break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit the website, dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And, you know, we want to talk a little bit about oil. In the southern Atlantic, the Falkland Islands were once at the forefront of a new era for the oil industry. Yet a decade after the discovery of about, almost 2 billion barrels of crude oil in surrounding waters, the British territory, known for sheep-rearing and tension with Argentina, looks as remote as ever. I don't know if that has anything to do, Dave, with the announcement today that the Trump administration gave way to oil and gas drilling in Alaska. Today they finalized a plan to allow oil and gas drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, putting it on track to issue decades-long leases in the pristine wild wilderness area before a potential change in leadership this year, which still remains to be seen. 19 million acres, and Republican passed bill that was in the 2017 tax bill was passed, opened that area to top oil and gas leasing, and the Interior Department said could hold a sale of oil and gas leases by the end of the year. And that was Secretary David Barnhart. He said in a conference call with reporters, he says, "I'm not really driven by the political dynamics of the November 3 presidential election." That's what has to make you laugh. And of course that's what it's being driven by. But anyway, if found, oil production could begin in about 8 years, with activity lasting about 50 years. So
what could go wrong?
Alaska's governor and a congressional delegation applauded the decision, saying it would create jobs and boost the state's economy. It's going to lead to a responsible development of Alaska's abundant resources, create new jobs, support economic growth and prosperity, most importantly, retain well into the future Alaska's critical role in our nation's energy policy. And that was from the governor. So there you have it. More oil. So, I don't know if that has... the Falklands... I mean, how's that... is that...
No, I think they're independent. Canned? Yeah, that is, as well as other places. BP said it's not going to do any new oil exploration. And Rystad Energy thinks the pandemic will likely speed up and discourage other exploration. The consultant expects about 10% of the world's recoverable oil resources, 125 billion barrels, to become obsolete. So it's, I think... this is a separate analysis that was probably done prior to the U.S. announcement about the project of new oil drilling in Alaska.
Today, our article comes out, and your article in today's edition is about Israel and the UAE peace deal, supposed peace deal.
Peace, I guess we should be in quotations. It's really a normalization deal is probably a word for it, although even that is probably misleading. I'll tell you why in a second. But the day after the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, announced last week that it was recognizing Israel, the local Israeli media framed it in these simple terms. It said Israel was dropping its planned annexation of 17% of the West Bank, and in return was receiving full diplomatic and economic relations with the UAE, known as an oil-rich Arab nation. Now, the UAE said its decision was primarily a move to avoid a divisive, if not catastrophic, annexation. UAE Minister of State for Foreign Affairs Anwar Gargash said, "I think we have bought a lot of time." Next door, however, the Palestinians were in disbelief, essentially responding with, "Say what?" They view the bilateral deal, in the words of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, as a stab in the back. And here's the misleading part of it. The UAE has been doing business clandestinely with Israel for years. Apparently such secretive dealings are par for the course in the Middle East. But by going public with a, quote, peace treaty, the UAE did something some are calling even revolutionary. It declared its independence from the Palestinian cause.
What are the implications of the deal? Are they promising or dire?
They're both in a sense. I mean, the UAE's decision to normalize relations with Israel is undoubtedly a win for both of those countries and, to a lesser extent, the Trump administration, which helped broker the deal. There's even a bigger victory in the offing, though, if all sides seize this opportunity to promote a broader real peace. In the short run, however, the world shouldn't be surprised, in my opinion, by ramped up volatility in the region, both in the form of street protests as well as increasing sectarian violence. Such hostilities, Melody, could come directly from the Palestinian grassroots, who certainly feel aggrieved by having been left out of these negotiations, much less an agreement. Or they could be driven by Hamas or even Iran or Russia, who look to undermine the UAE deal or use it to divide and conquer and as an excuse for ramped up aggression.
Are these three parties going to bask in this promising moment, and who else?
Well, they certainly are, though Israel's informal ties with the UAE have been apparently strong for years, although, below the surface and radar to some extent, and the deal merely brings them into the open. Nevertheless, it is a breakthrough. I mean, it's proof, especially if others like Bahrain and Oman follow the UAE's lead. It's proof that Israel can establish relations with a broader array of Arab countries before a final deal with the Palestinians, which have been on the table for since the mid-1960s. Now, besieged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will gratefully accept the reprieve from his political and legal difficulties. So will our own president, who's been eager to showcase some evidence of his deal-making skills ahead of November 3rd. And for its part, the UAE has earned itself some goodwill among both R's and D's in Washington, which will be useful in its struggle against its real geopolitical foe, Iran, as well as the chance to buy advanced weaponry from the U.S. Almost an aha.
But the leader of the UAE, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, Could he achieve a lot more?
Well, I believe so. I mean, based on what I'm reading, Melody, Bin Zayed traded recognition for a promise from Netanyahu to suspend his threat to annex a third of the West Bank. And that's how it was envisioned under the Trump administration's Middle East plan rolled out in January. Furious Palestinian leaders say that was merely a fig leaf. Regardless, the UAE now has a real chance to be a peacemaker. Although Netanyahu says annexation has only been suspended temporarily, presumably to appease to his country's right wing, the fact he can't afford to alienate MBZ, as the Crown Prince is known. Now, if MBZ is genuinely interested in pursuing a wider peace, Middle East observers say he should have little difficulty working to that end, at least with Egypt and Jordan. They're the only other Arab countries with existing normalized relations with Israel, and more important, with the U.S. And MBZ already has good relations with Trump and other officials here in the U.S. But here's the crux, though. Israeli hardliners will say the deal shows that they don't have to make peace with the Palestinians, that joint interests in technological and economic development, and especially in thwarting Iran's ambitions, will inescapably push Arab nations and Israel together.
But even by improving relations with other Arab countries, it's not going to automatically make the Palestinian issue go away.
Well, that's true indeed. In fact, by giving up on annexation, Netanyahu's effectively admitting, maybe, that Israel can't unilaterally impose its will in the West Bank. And any move now to restart the process of annexation or even to stand in the way of peace efforts would risk a break not just with the UAE, but with its other Arab partners, a move that could set back Middle East detente many years. Foreign policy experts say that Palestinian leaders, too, should see that they have to deal with the Israel they have, not the one they want. So rather than continuing to rant and rave, Palestinians will have to work with the UAE to develop pragmatic counterproposals to the Trump plan to the extent they disagree with them, and push to restart talks where they, the Palestinians, are full and productive participants. If they do, they could otherwise be what could otherwise be a limited two-party agreement could result in a real breakthrough and put the region much further ahead on the road to long-term and long-desired peace. But again, and this is, I think, real important, in the meantime, I suggest that we all be prepared for attempts, covert and overt, to make sure that doesn't happen anytime soon. Melody, geopolitical volatility, particularly in the Middle East, is soon going to be on the rise, and I just think that means a lot more violence, a lot more headlines, putting pressure on parties to come to the table to try and resolve their differences. We shall see.
We should. Well, we know there's never going to be peace in the Middle East. So, yeah. And you know, I mean, there's just. This isn't
thing
just
called
gonna,
history.
Yeah, this isn't just gonna, you know, shake hands, sign a deal, and everything's gonna be happy and over there. But talking about something here and something that I think is close to a lot of people is pizza.
Ah.
We're going from one extreme to the other here. Pizza. Pizza Hut. They're going to close up to 300 locations as part of a deal between the Yum! Brands chain and its largest U.S. franchisee, MPC, which will also put its remaining 927 Pizza Hut locations up for sale. The franchisee, which also operates nearly 400 Wendy's restaurants, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy back in early July after they struggled with about $1 billion worth of debt. The Pizza Hut spokesperson said in the event NPC executes a sale of its Pizza Hut business, they're going to focus, Pizza Hut's focus would be to ensure that the new ownership brings a strong capital structure, a healthy balance sheet, That's funny. Yeah. Commitment to operational excellence and a growth mindset. Well, anyway, 1,227 Pizza Hut locations account for a fifth of the chain's total U.S. footprint, Dave.
Yeah, boy. A healthy balance sheet.
I know. That kind of cracks me up. Like, who has a healthy balance sheet in today's world other than discount gold and silver?
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Well, certainly not. They're not looking anytime soon for a healthy menu.
No.
But that's another story. The vast majority of these Pizza Huts that are closing are expected to be dine-in locations. I didn't realize there were any non-dine-in
locations,
but yeah. Perhaps in the South and Southern California, parts of Arizona, that might be different. But in any event, the pizza chain does say it's shied away from its reputation as a dine-in restaurant and has sought to draw more attention to its delivery and takeout. Ah, okay, delivery and takeout, not outdoor dining. Certainly a change that's been accelerated by the pandemic.
Well, you know, I think this country has been so saturated with restaurants, and none of them, I mean, so many of them produce just subpar food. I mean, Pizza Hut used to have great pizza. And you could just see the decline to where you can barely eat it anymore. You know, maybe there were so many different franchises that, you know, some were good, some weren't. So you didn't go to any of them because, you know, rarely did you get the good ones. That's just like anything else. If you're not good, you're not going to survive. I remember the program on television where the one chef would go into these restaurants and, you know, he'd turn them around in, you know, so many days, and the biggest problem was their food, the cleanliness and their food. If you have bad food, who's going to go? But these restaurants, they've been, at one point in time when the economy is good, people would eat anywhere, and they would eat anything. Nobody ever complains about bad food. And because there was enough people always to replace the people that didn't go back. And it's not the case anymore. So, I mean, the more successful we've become as a nation, the less, you know, our quality declined. We desired, you know, we didn't expect. But I am expecting a break, and it's here now, so we'll be right back. Please stay tuned. We'll finish this up when we get back. I want to talk a little bit about Caterpillar.
Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Caterpillar reports 20% retail machine sales drop. Yep, reported worldwide rolling 3 months retail machine sales 20% year over year from 23% in June, with decline softening in construction and resource. As was the case in June, all regions were in minus, the one exception being the Asia-Pacific region. Declines did moderate, though, with North America down 35% from 38% in June. Again, it goes to show you what's going on around the world. It's a three-month rolling energy and transportation E&T sales to retail users that declined 6% year-over-year in July versus the 18% decrease in June. So, you know, hey.
Yeah, that's pretty significant. And what's important about Caterpillar is that they're one of the bellwethers of the Dow Jones Industrial Average and have been known more recently, but, you know, several years now, to some extent anyway, as goes Caterpillar, so goes the Dow Jones. And, the news of that downturn can't be good for paper investors.
No, not at all. And the thing of it is, this RBC Capital Seth Weber, he says, hey, you know, CAT is better positioned relative to prior cycles, but the demand and the margin trends, it's still going to remain relatively subdued. So, you know, there's no coming back.
No getting around that.
No. That's what we're trying to tell you. If you want to be optimistic about things, well, you know, be my guest. But it's kind of like a little bit like, you know, those restaurant owners that Gordon Ramsay would come into. You know, take a look around. I mean, you can figure it out. All's not well in the kitchen and the service area. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure it out. So it's just, and I'm not sure you have these money managers. I don't want touch too long on this, Dave. You can bring it and talk about the how bonds are one, how money managers want to market bonds. I mean, that's the bubble, granddaddy bubble of all. So yeah, they're going to have to find a new way to market them.
Yeah, market price and distribute, as it turns out. I mean, some of the biggest money managers now are particularly those, well, primarily those in investment grade credit, want to change the way that new bonds are marketed, priced, and distributed. And that's pushing Wall Street and regulators to adopt fresh industry standards, which everyone seems to be admitting are long overdue. There's this Credit Roundtable, which is an industry group that includes Vanguard and T. Rowe Price. They've authored a letter to various market participants calling for about a dozen changes. They include providing prospectuses immediately when deals are announced, to disclosing final order books as soon as they're priced. Now, the changes, they say, would greatly help asset managers' investment and compliance processes. And of course, the push comes as U.S. high-grade bond sales are on pace for a record year, already surpassing $1.3 trillion as of the end of July. Other recommendations, Melody, include allowing a minimum of 30 minutes between the start of the bond allocation process and the pricing of an offering, and setting a 4:30 p.m. New York time deadline for deals to get done before they become the next day's business. Mm. So, interesting stuff. I don't know if these are just referring to corporate bonds, or if they include treasuries and municipal bonds as well, but certainly someone who dealt with municipal bonds off and on for 20 some years, there's some significant changes like these that I'm sure would please both retail and institutional buyers.
Well, you know, with this layoffs that we've been having, you know, a lot of people, you know, in the service industries, restaurants and so forth, when they were furloughed, you know, they always thought that they'd be able to, you know, they would just wait until they could go back to work when the restaurant would reopen. But a lot of these thoughts are beginning to wane, that these people that were furloughed are beginning to understand that things are not looking so good, and that I might not be called to return to work. And the Great Recession was marked by mass layoffs and people walking out of their jobs. You know, it's funny that now that you have people sitting at home, they're anxiously waiting to return to their jobs when you have more than 18 million workers on furlough in April. That's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So 18 million, some came back to work, but that's still a lot of numbers, Dave.
Well, yeah, particularly if you compare it to 1982, which was the previous record at 2.5 million. And no kind of worker this time around has been immune. Even doctors and lawyers have been placed on temporary absences. And prior to this crisis, furloughs, a term that comes from the Dutch word verlof, meaning leave of absence, were mostly associated with U.S. federal government shutdowns. In the private sector, they were rarely used. During the Great Recession, fewer than 1% of employees were furloughed, compared to 1 in 5 who were let go. The recent flood of furloughs could be a positive sign, though, according to this one professor at Georgetown University, Keith Hall, who's also a former commissioner at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He said, the expectation in the Great Recession was that it was going to last a very long time, so there weren't many furloughs. Despite the pandemic, he said, companies are hoping to get back into business pretty quickly. Indeed, the number of furloughed workers has already dropped to 9 million by the end of July, from 18 million that Melody mentioned in April. Over the last 2 months, Hall added, all the job growth we've had has been furloughed folks getting reemployed. These aren't new jobs now, ladies and gentlemen. And there are clear advantages to a furlough compared to a layoff. Beyond the hope that you'll return to your job, many employers continue to pay for their workers' health insurance during their leave. Furloughed employees can also typically receive unemployment benefits. Yet furloughed employees are often never brought back and can put themselves at a disadvantage by staying on the sidelines. Essentially, what that means in terms of reporting is that they go from being a U3 unemployed worker to a U6 unemployed worker, still unemployed and out of work, is the bottom line, Melody.
You know, it really is. But, you know, it's amazing how people, even though they're furloughed, I wouldn't sit and wait to be called back. I mean, who does that? I mean, you get the promise from your boss, we're going to call you back, but what obligation do you have to sit and wait for that phone call to come through? Who sits and waits?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of Yeah. A lot of furloughed employees are finding loyalty is one way.
Yeah, but I mean, it's your responsibility to take care of yourself.
No, absolutely.
So if I wait and it's like, gee, I need to get back to work. I can't wait for him to call. But they're not. They're sitting and waiting until it gets turned into a layoff. So, I mean, it's, I don't know, to me that's baffling, you know, but it's just the mindset of today's world, of the worker today. And I did read, though, that, you know, if you're furloughed, and this could be a big part of it, that if you're furloughed, some of those firms continue to pay your health insurance, but I wouldn't think in the service industry that would be part of it. You know,
very few of those companies.
Yeah.
Are probably offering that.
Yeah, so, you know, could it be, and I don't know if you're furloughed, if you get the $600 a week.
Yes.
So that's probably a big part of it. Well, I'll just sit here and collect my $600 and wait for my boss to call me back. So, you know, so, and, you know, I guess it's almost like that catch-22 type thing, suppose, you know.
I think that's right on. I think you hit the nail on the head.
Well, you know, we had this big geopolitical policy battle of 2020 U.S. presidential election. And the one thing is, who's going to be tougher on China? And I really think it's really kind of funny to some degree, because we're not going to be tough on China. We can't be tough on China. And because we're linked. The U.S. and China's economic fortunes are linked in a way America and the Soviet Unions never were. Sure, they're technological and innovation battles to be had, but there's a real clash of models and values underway. The aging heavyweight and a rising, increasingly aggressive one, shutting off any pretenses, transitioning to any democracy. But you know, Dave, where does this the Trump administration's current attacks on China are being done in isolation from the country's business and economic realities? A lot of hawks in D.C. thinks that's a good thing, is it?
Well, the president, of course, says he's changed his mind on China since the pandemic arrived here.
True.
But Trump also continues to express the desire to continue to do business, just as he did on Saturday when he cited recent Chinese purchases of corn and beef and soybeans. You can see it, too, in the way his administration has shied away from killing the trade deal that was signed in January. The reality is that neither side has any interest in scrapping the pact. Trade? Why? Because trade is one area where the dialogue between the two sides remains semi-sober. But both sides also have at least a medium-term economic interest. Chinese needs American demand. At some point soon, the U.S. recovery will anchor for increased Chinese consumption. And whoever sits in the White House come this time next year won't want a repeat performance of the last two. That is, you know, further tit for tat tariffs, which would signal a more protracted global economic malaise. More so, there are domestic constituencies far beyond farm states that want and need to sell to China. So, tough on China may be the message now, Melody, but before too long, selling to China will once again be in demand.
And you know, there's about the U.S.-China Business Council, they found that nearly 70% of member companies, they're optimistic about the five-year business outlook in China. The survey showed that 83% counted China as either the top priority for their company's global strategy or among the top five. And at the same time, 86% of the organization's more than 200 member companies reported that bilateral trade tensions have affected their business in China. 87% of companies reported no plans to move production out of the country.
Wow.
87%. Only 4% said they had shifted or plan to shift operations to the U.S. because of lagging consumer demand in China.
Oh, my.
The remaining 11% reported recent or planned production moves to other parts of the world. That's what we've been saying all along. Yeah. There's no manufacturing or companies coming back to the States. Not in any meaningful way. Not as we're going. Not as we continue to go the same as we are. And I'll change my opinion when President Donald Trump brings his manufacturing back to the United States. Let him be the first one. Set the example, Dave.
Well, it looks like profitability is a key factor for long-term confidence in the Chinese market. That's certainly not a surprise. I mean, that's what it's all about, really. The survey showed that 91% of companies said their Chinese operations are profitable, although at a larger, at a lower margin than before. Now, the year before that, 2019, 69% of companies said they had seen revenues grow, and that was down from 79% in 2018 and a significant 87% in 2017.
I hear the music. We're out of time. Sorry, folks, but we'll be here tomorrow, so please make sure you join us, and we want to thank you for taking the time out to listen to us today, and if you have any questions, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. We'll be back tomorrow, so until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye.